Yeah, I don't know what we're talking about at all.
We don't either.
it just happens.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. All right.
This is Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon, bringing to you the best in news, reviews, and interviews with people making the bourbon whiskey industry happen, and I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Coleman. We all come from different backgrounds. Yes, all of us, and I'm talking about you too. And we all find a passion in bourbon. And one of the most intriguing stories that I've been introduced to is from our guest today, Caroline Paulus. Her first love and her area of study is archaeology, and she had no idea that coming to Kentucky from Wisconsin on a dig would actually lead her into a new career in bourbon. She's fascinated with the history of whiskey, and that has made her become one of the leading authorities when it comes to analyzing dusty bourbons. And as a whiskey historian at Justin's House of Bourbon and the senior editor for the Bourbon Review, she tells her story about falling in love with this line of work and some of the stories about running one of the best stores dedicated to bourbon here in Kentucky. Well, with that, enjoy this week's episode. Now here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. This week's idea comes from Chris Tauber, I hope I said that right, who is a Patreon member and writes me on fredminnick.com. After Kenny's request on Bourbon Pursuit Patreon community, I had a few questions. I plucked one here that I really like, Chris. Tell us about the distilling industry's role in World War II and the prohibition of making beverage during the war. Well, thank you for that great question, Chris. That's a big, that's basically an entire chapter in my book, Bourbon, the Rise, Fall, and Rebirth of American Whiskey. And prior to my research on this, the gospel from the distillers was that everybody volunteered. Everyone was so excited to make industrial alcohol from the war movement, and they were just wanting to help our great country. Well, part of that was true, but the fact is they were forced to stop making alcohol. In October 1942, in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, every distiller got a cease and desist from or some kind of formal letter from the United States government saying that they were no longer permitted to make alcohol. Distillers in Pennsylvania, Maryland, New York, and Missouri all got letters prior, so they were kind of cut off beforehand. But Kentucky was able, you know, Kentucky lobbyists and have always had incredible access to Congress and the Senate to benefit distillers. It's been the case for a long time. And so they had the longest runtime of making whiskey during World War II. But the government said, if you want to still make money, we need industrial alcohol. And so you can outfit your stills to make industrial alcohol. And that will be used for jeeps, gunpowder, parachutes, etc. You know, whatever you need industrial alcohol for. You know, it was used in the manufacturing of war materials. So they get all together, and some distillers decide that they cannot afford to take the hit. So you had companies like the Blair Distilling Company in Marion County. They just folded, and that was an incredible legacy of distilling history, just gone. You had mid-tier companies, you know, sell to bigger ones because they couldn't afford it. They thought there was another full-on prohibition, and no one really knew what was going to happen during World War II. So there was a lot of uncertainty. So that became where the rise of Brown-Forman, National Distiller, Schenley, Seagram's, and a few other companies, they were going around acquiring, and they were just making, you know, they were making industrial alcohol, but they were also growing their portfolios. Now, at this time, these companies would also have interest in suitcase companies, pharmaceutical companies. So they had their, you know, the whiskey was just a part of a portfolio. And the whiskey presidents were using this as an opportunity to buy up the little guys. So that was really what the World War II movement did with industrial alcohol. Was it was the end of independent distillers. There would be a few here and there, but for the most part, independent distillers got gobbled up or went out of business during World War II. And coming out of World War II, all those distillers who did that were brought into the Senate to testify before hearings about price fixing, about gobbling up these smaller brands, about using mafioso tactics to sell alcohol. And that is why we have so many laws today that basically try to protect consumers from collaborative agreements with distillers on prices. But if you want to learn more about that, check out my book, Bourbon. The history's all in there. But the great question, Chris. Thank you for reaching out. If you would like to be like Chris, hit me up on fredminnick.com. If I like your idea for Above the Char, I'll read it on the air. Until next week, cheers.
From their bar to yours, Chad and Sarah of the popular YouTube channel It's Bourbon Night bring you their favorite at-home old-fashioned mix with the new Elemental Elixirs Golden Hour Syrup. It's a custom-made syrup with notes of bold black tea, warm spices, and orange zest. All you need is your favorite whiskey and ice. No bitters needed. One bottle makes 16 drinks, so that's only $1 cocktail before you add your own whiskey. They can also be enjoyed in other cocktails or spirits, mocktails, coffee, tea, and anything you can think of. It's crafted locally in Lexington, Kentucky, and you can get your bottle now at whiskeyambitions.com.
It's that time again to get bourbon strong with Give270. Purchase your $50 tickets for your chance to win from our 50 bourbon prizes. Don't miss out on rare bottles and grand prizes like the legendary Pappy Set, a Weller Rainbow, and the Blood Oath Trilogy. Hurry, only 3,000 tickets are available. Single bottle winners go back in for the grand prize draw. Will you win the ultimate Pappy Set or one of our other incredible prizes? Get your tickets now at Give270.org. Charitable gaming license ORG 000-2703.
It's that time of the year where everybody's starting to make their vacation plans on visiting Kentucky, the mecca of bourbon. And if you are coming to Kentucky, you need to make sure you visit us at Pursuit Spirits in Louisville. We're right in the heart of Clifton, near Butchertown and Nulu, and only just a few miles away from downtown Louisville. But when you do come, you need to book your experience to go do our whole shebang. This is the one that's really the star of the show. You get a full-on tasting. You get to do your own personal barrel selection experience. And you get to grab a whiskey thief and fill your bottle directly from the barrel. We're doing something completely brand new that nobody else is doing here in bourbon country. Plus, you get a free sweet tasting glass at the end of it. I guarantee you, you're going to end up being one of the many people that's also leaving us a 5-star review. So make sure you come and check us out. You can book your reservation by going to pursuitspirits.com and clicking the Visit Us button. From Jim Beam to Maker's Mark, their brand and label are the only things more iconic than a bourbon's taste. And that's why we've partnered with Sticker Mountain, a company focused on helping you make a statement with your labels and stickers. Embracing cutting-edge embellishment technology allows them to add foil, raise texture, and more to make your product stand out, all at competitive prices with market-leading turnaround and customer service that treats you like a business partner. And that's why right now you can get 10% off your order with coupon code STICKYBOURBON at StickerMountain.com. See the difference they can make for you and your business at StickerMountain.com using coupon code STICKYBOURBON. Welcome, everybody. We're back with another episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. The whole crew here today to be able to talk to a good friend of ours. We've known her for a very long time, but we've known her through the whiskey side of things forever, and she's always been very generous with her knowledge when it comes to bourbon history and bourbon dusties and everything like that. And I know we're going to be able to talk about that a good bunch today. So, Ryan, how have you been introduced to our guest before?
You know, if I want some dusty pours, when Caroline's at the shop, I'm like, let's go. Let's drop everything we're doing because she's going to walk us through, show us, let's taste through everything. Caroline's great. We've had a great working relationship, you know, throughout the years, and excited that everybody else gets to learn more about her and see what she's all, you know, what she does in this for this great community we have.
Yeah, I know. I think this is going to be a battle of minds between Fred and Caroline over here see who's got.
I feel
who's
like
got
I'm the, just going to get some popcorn.
No,
and,
no battle maybe whatsoever.
Maybe a couple bottles.
I get excited to talk about whiskey history, no matter what. I mean, that's one of the misnomers about I think on the like the whiskey historian side is like we all get along and we all like to talk about the fake history that brands have been putting out and the real history, because there's a whole lot of fake history. And I think that's one of the things that I love about Caroline, is she gives it real. So that's what this could be a good show.
I know. And you've probably read a lot of her articles online. If you've ever stopped into Lexington's Just a House of Bourbon, she's probably there as well. So let's go ahead and introduce her on the show today. So today on the show, we have Caroline Paulus. So Caroline is the whiskey historian at Justin's House of Bourbon, and she is also the senior editor for the Bourbon Review. So Caroline, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yes.
Good to see you.
So we kind of talked about before we started recording here. So let's rewind back the hands of time here a little bit before whiskey was really a thing for you. So kind of talk about your past and growing up. Was whiskey ever a thing in your household, or was it something that you found a love for sort of later on in life?
Definitely something that came much later. I think of all the German and Irish Catholics in Wisconsin, I had the only two teetotaler parents. So it was not anything I ever considered that I would have anything to do with as a career until I moved to Kentucky.
And so where in Wisconsin?
I'm from Burlington, Wisconsin, technically Boner's Lake, but no one knows where that is, and it's hard to explain. So
actually,
somewhere in Wisconsin.
I do know that area. I lived in Milwaukee for a while, and that area, I know a lot of people that would vacation there.
Yeah.
So Wisconsin is such a great state, and the amount of alcohol they consume in that state is off the charts. I think per capita, it's amazing how much they drink.
So it's because it's so cold. Like they're like,
yeah. I think it's the heritage. Like you have like every drinking heritage, every culture that ended up in Wisconsin all came from drinking cultures, Irish, Catholic, even the Norwegian, like all. All drinkers.
Yes.
Okay. Can we take a minute to say, this is probably where any Wisconsin listeners are going to hate me. They make the most terrible old fashioned. Am I right or wrong?
It's different. It's just different. It's not terrible.
They make a brandy or something.
They make a brandy. They do the whole muddled thing.
Wisconsin actually drinks 90% of America's brandy. So I have to drop like a Korbel ad here, I guess, or something. but they do make their old fashions differently. There's fruit squished up in the bottom of your glass, usually with a packet of just white sugar.
Big red flag.
actually called an orange cherry flag. So. But then they add the ice and the brandy, and then you can get it sweet or sour. So when I ordered an old fashioned here and was handed basically 2 ounces of whiskey in a cup, where they looked at it with a bitters bottle and a sugar cube, was very, very different than what I was used to. And now it's better, but then I was scared. Yeah,
I think culturally though, I mean that's Wisconsin. Wisconsin is an original state. They're unique, and they're always going to do their own thing. I mean, you went to University of Wisconsin, go to a Badgers game and tell me that you don't have a better experience watching a band play than at University of Wisconsin. I mean, they just...
Like a marching band or a band?
Yeah.
Band?
Yeah.
Mike LaCrone was the director of our band for over 50 years. We've been named the number one college football game day school by somebody that I don't think knew as much about it. U.S. News and World Report, maybe, but... We have a great football game day. Yeah,
it's amazing.
It's like a running back factory too.
And then
like every running back
and offensive lineman. But the best thing about my favorite thing about Wisconsin was Halloween. Like you'd go there.
Oh, okay, I want to hear where this is going.
Flawless.
This is just going to be an episode of Wisconsin, brought to you by Wisconsin. Come visit us.
We'll call them.
I remember I lived there for 5 years minus in the unit that I went to Iraq with. Was a Wisconsin unit, and so like everybody I was there with was Wisconsinite, and some Illinois people, fibs as you all would call them,
or fish tabs.
We're so out of the loop.
So you can take fib, yeah.
Yeah. It's fib is fucking Illinois bastards.
Okay.
Wisconsinites.
Yeah. And a fish tab, living as close as I did to Lake Geneva, is a fucking Illinois shithead towing a boat.
So that's funny you said. When I was at Lake Cumberland growing up, my parents and like my uncles would all call them fifis, fucking idiots from Indiana, because they would come down, they'd block the boat ramp, they would like park their truck and unhaul their shit. Well, there's like 20 trucks in a row, but yeah, that's funny that now I'm in on it.
But Halloween. Mm-hmm. Like you'd go there and people they dress to the nines. I mean, they really do get into it. And Wisconsin is a very welcoming, drinking party state. So I feel like this is where all cliques are like abandoned. Like you could be like a math geek and end up going to the biggest fraternity party at Wisconsin, you'd be welcome. And that was the one thing I loved about Wisconsin, is that it was so welcoming, you know, in certain circles. Most of the time they were like, get the hell away from me. But in like game day, Halloween, you know, just like everybody was very festive and I loved it.
If you don't have a beer will be provided for you.
Yeah.
Or an old fashioned with a bunch of sugar.
Or a brat, you know, with a bunch of grilled onions on it. Just whatever.
And the beer selection in Wisconsin, unbelievable.
Leinenkugel's, Spotted Cow, you know, New Glarus. Mm. Their fruited new stuff is really good too.
And what was my favorite one?
I did have some New Glarus before. It is pretty good. I'm not a big fan of sour beers that they're really known for. Yeah. But oof, I don't
They've
know.
They've gotten known for them, but Spotted Cow was the original. Yeah.
Yes. Mm.
Yeah. There's a brand I can't think of. It's named after a town there. It's been so long, but I used to love this beer, and I haven't seen it since. Saint something.
A lot of French ones up north.
Yeah, she's a whiskey historian, not a beer historian.
I can't think of it right now. I'm gonna Google it.
All right. I've had enough Wisconsin.
All right, I'm done with Wisconsin.
I'll do one more. Actually, I've got my family is actually from Kenosha.
Oh, never mind.
So, oh, that's where my mom works.
And so it's worked. Always got to hear about, it's not called Coke. It's soda or pop.
Soda.
And soda. You don't go to the red light, it's the stop and go light.
Like, no so way, stop and go light.
Yeah. Oh,
so never heard that.
She's smiling over there because she knows it's true.
What do you drink out of? Like if there's a place next to the bathroom for you to get some water?
I guess it's not a fountain. What is it?
It's a bubbler in Wisconsin.
Okay, right.
A bubbler, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Huh. And you have to bring your own birthday cake to the birthday party. In Wisconsin.
I did not know that.
A birthday cake was provided for me, but I was very small there, so I think they didn't make me do that.
There you go. Makes sense. Okay, so let's move.
Moving on.
Okay, so you go to University of Wisconsin.
Yes.
What's your area of study there? Because we talked about before that you've really been to archaeology.
So. Yeah, so I had a degree in anthropology, biological anthropology, and was focusing on human evolution. Tried, applied, and was accepted to a dig in Swartkrans as a study abroad one summer, and my health didn't end up allowing me to go, so I took a smaller dig that was local. And while I was there, you know, it was at a park called Aztlan in Wisconsin, and it was May. I was living in a tent below 40 at nights.
Oh gosh.
It was very, very cold, miserable work, and I was just in love with it. I was just obsessed. I couldn't wait to wake up, and my fingers were so cold and arthritic, I couldn't even like get them around the shovel.
Digging just for artifacts?
Yeah, digging for really, it's a beautiful, beautiful native site there. They have earthen mounds. We found, you know, huge array of arrowheads, even copper Indian jewelry and animal bone. Eventually, I think they ended up determining it was a feasting site, but...
What do you mean? Feasting?
Like a party.
Okay.
Yeah. which is, you know, something I still kind of laugh at because it's... very similar to what we do today, you know, sharing and drinking and celebrating. But
hopefully our bones just aren't sitting there still.
They will one day.
All our empty bourbon bottles.
Yeah. One day an archaeologist will try and glue that together for you. Yeah. You know, ceramics, stuff like that. We found all kinds of things. But coming out of that, I thought, wow, you know, I always thought I wanted to work, you know, with human genetics, with human evolution, and ended up thinking maybe for just a few years, I will just have a bachelor's degree and do some archaeology because it's a study of a subsect of anthropology that you can really actually get a job, not a well-paying one, but a job to do with only a bachelor's. Generally, you need a master's or a doctorate to work in anthropology. But so I decided I would do a few years of it, and I got a job down in Kentucky, and I moved here having to, you know, sell the pieces of furniture from my college house that I wasn't going to use to get the gas to move down. I mean, can't tell you how broke I was to come make $13 an hour to dig holes on the side of the road in a yellow vest. And I was just thrilled about it. Couldn't have been happier.
What were you originally looking for? What was the...
I did what was called cultural resource management with a firm based out of Lexington. So we would get a contract from a state or federal government where they were going to put in a road or a bridge or a, you know, a railroad, anything like that. And we would go ahead of that construction and make sure that anything that had cultural value, you know, would be saved, or if we needed to avert the path, we would...
Like an Indian burial ground.
Exactly.
Or
even, you know, a relevant and important historical farm site.
I thought that just the people that didn't want the road to come through there would hire you all to be like, delay.
They're looking for something.
It's like in Yellowstone. They're like, we'll just create an environmental study. So.
No, I remember actually, the people didn't always want us there. On my very first day ever digging, I had my hair kind of put up in a hat. And I'm tall. I'm 6 feet tall. So I didn't look particularly feminine that day. And I was digging out in Eastern Kentucky, and popped my head up and saw about 10 feet away from me, somebody was coming at me with a pipe. And when he saw I was a girl, he put it down by his side. But yeah, I don't think everybody always wants us out there. But once I explained what we were doing, he was okay with it.
Okay. Well, Eastern Kentucky, you could have been at a moonshiner drop,
oh, yeah,
a meth drop. Who knows?
Yeah. A lot of directions that could have went.
Yeah.
Could have gotten sour real quick.
Yeah, yeah. It was wild out there.
Before we kind of dive into more of that, I want to ask you a question. Since you're the only archaeologist we've ever had on here, what did Jurassic Park get right and what did it get wrong?
That is actually paleontology. So when you have a paleontologist on, so you can ask them.
Indiana Jones would be
your... Oh, okay.
This is shameful secret time. I've never seen Indiana Jones.
Really?
I can't sit still for very many movies. I don't see very many at all. But now that it's been so long and I haven't seen it, I need like fanfare for it, you know? I need a whole movie night. Projector, yeah. Snacks, themes.
Because I remember talking to you one time, and I think we were at Justin's, and you were kind of talking about this woolly mammoth or this like saber skull that had been discovered, and you were like going all antsy about it. So I was kind of figuring like that's where it all pulled from.
So that it's interesting with Paleolithic megafauna. When you hear Paleolithic, lithic means stone, so that means it actually was fauna that was present, animals that were present in the United States when people had made it here. Dinosaurs, no overlap with people. Whatever the Creation Museum may tell you. none
so this is where your evolution knowledge really yes. comes in here.
They
so
have a people, dinosaur on the ark.
People weren't
Did
riding
they have
around.
Two? Because maybe that's where the dinosaurs went.
Oh my gosh.
Two of each.
So people were not riding around on saber-toothed tigers, what you're trying to tell me.
Well, saber-tooths were, you know,
oh, there we go.
Alive at the same time as people, but they, you know, they didn't interact very often. But when you think of mammoths and mastodons, you know, large-scale fauna like that, dire wolves, actually a real thing that was, you yeah. know, a North American mammal present here when people were, and you'll find evidence that they coexisted, at least not coexisted.
How old? How long ago?
10,000 years.
10,000. Yeah.
Kentucky's actually Big Bone Lick, a very, very famous megafauna site. If you look at Thomas Jefferson's kind of reign as a top politician in the United States and in the early days, what he did to help solidify the U.S. as a country that had cultural relevance was send a lot of the megafauna skeletons, mammoths in particular, to museums all over Europe. And a lot of them were from Big Bone Lick in particular.
So archaeology has been an incredible resource for almost all of my work, but especially my book on Mead. There was so much I pulled from like digs in Russia and like Denmark or what would be like Viking territories and stuff. And so like archaeology is kind of like that first piece of like history. Like historians will go in and like interpret and kind of build around some of the archaeological stuff. But that the stuff that archaeologists find, especially in our world, it begins with beer and mead, you know, some of those first things. And you can find it in like cuneiform tablets and so forth. I wish there was more done that was open in China. Because, you know, I think we could probably find the early distillations in China, but it's not very public. But like what I have been able to extract from archaeology digs in the, you know, my career has been a big part of what's in my mead and rum and whiskey women books. How did you, what was the leap from archaeology to bourbon?
It was a bit accidental in the sense that I started going to a bourbon bar, Bell's Cocktail House in Lexington, quite a bit. Maybe too much, some might say. But while I was there, I met some guys, Justin Thompson, Seth Thompson, Bob Edson, and Justin Sloan. And I was doing, you know, all kinds of little things to pay the bills while I fed my archaeology habit. But I was writing a little bit for other friends that had, you know, websites or whatnot. And they said, hey, you know, you could write some bourbon articles for us. You seem to know how to drink bourbon.
when you say write, like what were you ghostwriting things or just
no,
like random things?
I was just
things?
Chopping up press releases. That was it.
Okay.
You know, the first article I ever wrote, and it was terrible now looking back at it, was about the Basil Hayden 10-year release, Basil Hayden Rye release. It was the Basil Hayden Rye release in April of 2017,
Caribbean
maybe.
Caribbean.
No, they had just a Basil Hayden like rye, like a green label rye.
Huh. There it is.
That's see, now that's the 10-year.
Oh.
Yeah,
sorry.
There was like an old one. Maybe it was called 2x2 rye or something?
I don't know.
I'll find it.
Kenny's not an archaeologist.
I'll send it to you after I edit it and post it.
I don't recall that. I have never been a fan of Basil Hayden, so that one just gets deleted in my brain.
Yeah.
Or like, to saving for other things.
But yeah, they just sent me press releases. I remember sitting down with JT and he kind of talked me through what it should look like and how to just basically make it factual. Nothing too fancy, nothing, you know, just chop out all their fluff and lay out the facts.
Yeah.
So I did that. And then I did a few more and I started drinking more with them. And they gave me things that I really, at that point in my bourbon career, shouldn't have had. You know, I definitely had an interest in food and beverage. I had made some couple terrible home brews and I had worked as a sous chef at a farm to table restaurant. So I had some decent floor knowledge for it. But I remember maybe after I had been working for them, writing for them for a month, I mentioned to someone, yeah, we had a Pappy 16 last night. It was really good. And they kind of looked at me and they was like, there's not a Pappy 16. I was like, I drank one. It was a Van Winkle 16. I think it had red on it. So red. I mean, they just let me try everything. So it was really just baptism by fire and drinking everything I could get my hands on.
It's a good way to come up.
Yeah, it really was. I'm very spoiled.
What was the landscape like for the Bourbon Review? Like, I mean, how big a reach did they have back then or when you started?
I mean, they at that point, they were in all 50 states already. And this is 5 years ago, but they had at that point been doing it 8 years. So they were in all 50 states. I think they had 31, maybe more countries. They already had 50,000 Instagram followers. I mean, it was their email list was over 100,000. So big for the time.
Big for bourbon still.
Big for bourbon.
Yeah. Big for bourbon still.
Yeah. And now it's, you know, twice all that. But
yeah, for sure.
Did you see it and be like, wow, this is crazy. This is bigger. There's a future here for me.
Not at all. I thought I would keep doing archaeology forever. And this was something that I could write on the side and it would be really nice. And then the boys opened a vintage whiskey shop. And I thought, maybe I won't ever have to live in a tent ever again.
I mean, it's good. It's a good fit. Mm-hmm. It's a good fit.
Yeah.
Did you ever work with Nick on any of the bourbon archaeology?
No, dicks? I'm just such like a fangirl of his. He has no idea who I am, I'm sure. Actually, he just followed me on Instagram maybe like a week ago. But
who's Nick?
Nick Laraquente, bourbon archaeologist.
We had him on the podcast a long time ago.
So I'm not the only archaeologist that's ever been on this podcast.
True. Now that I think about it.
Yeah. Nicholas Laraquente came first and definitely best. But I'm a huge fan of his work, but I've never met him and he has no idea who I am.
Great guy.
We can make that happen.
I would love that. I've so many times I've been like, I should just email him and see if he just wants to, you know, get a drink, but I don't want to be weird, you know.
Come to Justin's. We'll open up Dusty's.
Yes, it'll be great.
That's one way. I mean, I guess that's kind of cool from your background. And now that I think Nick had a little bit different experience going into it, because Nick really wasn't into bourbon. He kind of got contracted through Buffalo Trace and through other different things to actually go and explore this stuff. And then that's kind of how he found his sort of knack for bourbon. But I just don't think he might have even been at the layer that you're at. And so you're kind of coming from an opposite direction where you've known really about archaeology, but then you really have this fascination for bourbon and you could really marry the two together. I mean, do you picture, because I know that we talked to him before and he says, yeah, we're open to anybody that just wants to come and help us dig and start putting the shovel in the ground and start digging up some of these farm fields.
They would have to physically remove me at 10 p.m. Like that would be great. Yeah.
The tent out here would probably be a little warmer too.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, that was a part of the reason I chose a contract in Kentucky when I first started. Because like I said, it's so cold, you can't open your fingers in the morning because they've been gripping a shovel all day.
You went polar opposite. You're like, I want it as hot, as humid as possible.
Yeah,
I went on a dig. Sweat my ass off.
I had a dig once in South Carolina and it was too hot and I threw up. So I had to stay right in the middle with Kentucky.
It's amazing. Most kids go to college to not dig ditches.
First of all. It's very, you know, the world does need ditch diggers.
I did the same thing. I'm in turf management for school. I'm like, why did I go to school for that?
Here we are.
Yeah, here we are. Now we're in the bourbon. No wonder.
Yeah.
Find a new path. Always find a new path. Yeah. So I guess the next logical question is so the boys bring you on, mm-hmm. right? And do you immediately come on as whiskey historian or do you come on as just help for the shop? Like what led you down the path of really wanting to go all in and learning about history and everything like that?
Yeah, no, I originally came on just to work the cash register. Myself and Brian Booth were the first two employees. We stocked the shelves before we ever opened and we're still here. Brian Booth running the Louisville store now and me in the Lexington store, which is run by Ryan Alvis. But I was just kind of there to be there 2 days a week because Booth could mostly handle it. We didn't really have much foot traffic when we first opened. And it's just me and him for the first, few months, you know, and minimal people coming through. It eventually started to build up steam around April of 2018. We started to be busy enough to need more help. But yeah, it was a couple days a week. Just I would sit and write. And if somebody came in, I would try to talk to them and sell them a bottle of bourbon.
Writing about what? Just
for Bourbon Review. Yeah. Okay, press releases and stuff, little things.
Because you've also changed some of your writing style over the years too. Like you're just not chopping up press releases, but you're creating kind of more in-depth articles as well.
Yeah, definitely. I've attempted to do that. Hopefully it's being seen. But yeah, it was originally just doing press releases and little things like that. And now larger interviews, I wouldn't say investigative, but larger research-based articles. And just recently did my first article that I would consider in the first person, which was my experience losing my taste and smell during COVID.
Yeah.
So
how
I guess
are you now?
I'm back. This is a terrible story. I'm so sorry. I'm going to ruin your podcast with this. But this morning I was walking my dog and I scooped his business and I could smell it from 3 feet away, which was amazing. I've never been happier to smell that in my entire life.
That's the human instinct kicking in.
I'm back.
Yeah, I'm back.
You can smell the stink.
Yep. It was great. But it has been even the last thing to kind of come is like stuff that's in the air, you know, like yeah. I still can't smell, you know, things that are a few feet away from me where I used to, there was one time I walked in to the office of the shop and there was a glass of Starlight cigar blend on the desk from me to this light. And I said, what is that? He said, what's what? And I said, what smells like that? He goes, oh, I got something for you to drink. And I was like, that's what it is. Like, I used to be able to smell something from across the room and now it's like still getting there. But other than that, food tastes normal, which is great. Didn't even lose long enough to lose any weight. So,
who taught you to get your palate to where it is? Kind of get you like comfortable with like tasting whiskey and learning and how to appreciate it, how to understand what's good, how to validate it. Who was kind of your like mentor in that regard?
Yeah, because she needs it because she does she has to write the notes for 200 barrels.
I know that's what she was saying. I was like, good God, we did 50, and I couldn't imagine doing 150 more.
Yeah, it's between, you know, two stores and for clients as well. But yeah, definitely Justin Sloan and Justin Thompson. And reading other people's notes, listening to what everybody had to say, this is, again, another person I'm a huge fangirl of, and I don't think she knows who I am, but Nancy Fraley. Sometimes I think I know what I'm doing, you know, and I'll write a nice little paragraph of tasting notes for a nice barrel pick. And then I read her notes for the Joseph Magnus cigar blend, and I'm like, I'm a fraud, man. Like, I should quit.
Nancy's great.
Oh my god, I've
re-listened to our podcast to learn about blending. She's just a master of everything, yeah, you know, whiskey.
Yeah, I mean, just a fantastically talented human being.
So you start taking on this role. You're in the store, but what point do you kind of flip that switch and become the historian? If you're anything like me, then you can't get enough about bourbon. And that's why I'm a subscriber to Bourbon Plus magazine. Bourbon Plus is a quarterly publication that tells the stories from the heart of bourbon. The farmers who grow the grain, the distillers who labor over the process, and the people, like you and me, who raise their glasses to celebrate it all. Subscribe to Bourbon Plus magazine today at bourbonplus.com, that's PLUS.com, and use code PURSUIT at checkout for $5 off your subscription. Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. And with Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. And you can get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/bourbon, all lowercase, and go to shopify.com/bourbon to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/bourbon. So you start taking on this role, you're in the store, but what point do you kind of flip that switch and become the historian?
I believe that was 2019. This is funny. So I was still
here. So we go. Story
still,
time.
Yeah, this is Justin Sloan's business acumen right here. I was still
kind
of writing part time, and I was, you know, going to yoga during the day and walking people's dogs or babysitting people's dogs and working at the shop a couple days a week. So still hadn't really fully committed to bourbon. You know, picking up digs where I could. You know, 2-3 weeks contract here, but I came into work one day and I must have looked frazzled or something. And Sloan said, "What's wrong, honey?" And I said, oh my gosh, you know, all my friends are having destination weddings this year. Like, I don't know how I'm going to pay for all this. Like I said, archaeology, you know, $12.50 an hour. it's not great.
It's just enough to survive. At that point.
I was feeding myself. And he said, okay, all right, all right. And the next day he took me to lunch and he was like, do you want to work full time with us? And I said, okay, like, let me think about it, you know, because I'd have to give up doing digs and, you know, other little things. He said, you can still write for Bourbon Review, and but this is, you know, a full-time offer. And I thought about it and I said, okay, like, I'll do it, but I want my title to be whiskey historian.
Did you get a sign on your door?
I didn't. No, we share an office, but I have business cards. So you guys can have one if you want.
And so you got the title, but what actually took you to wanting to learn more about the history? Because, I mean, you talk about, you're doing your archaeology thing on the side, you're reading press releases, but I've talked to you before and you're a wealth of knowledge when it comes to, I'll find a few bottles or say, hey, somebody tries to sell me something. Can you tell me about these? Because I don't really know much about some of these old labels. They could be old National Distillers or Heaven Hill things, because Heaven Hill's got 42,000 different labels. So how did you really start getting into the knowledge space?
Before I had the title of the job, I was already doing the job. You know, if a bottle came in, it was like, okay, Caroline, go figure out what you can about this, because they knew I had a research background and they knew that I had an interest in history. The work came very naturally. It came before the title. And it would, you know, just be me back in the speakeasy or at the bar for 2 hours until I would come up and say, okay, this is what it is. But
it's like when Pawn Stars, you show up and they're like, let me talk to my expert. So you're the expert.
I hate that. I don't think I'm an expert at all, but I just want to know everything I can about it. I would never claim to already know everything I do, you know, or everything that there is to know. I just want to learn more every day.
Walk us through your process a little bit, because I know that I've shown you pictures before and I'm like, I don't know what these are. I don't know what the value is. So how do you kind of come to learning about the whiskey, kind of knowing what's in it, where it came from, where it originated, and then getting into sort of valuation sort of stuff?
The easiest way to do it is to be surrounded by a vintage bourbon bar like I am and drink it every day and compare and contrast. I mean, it's tiny little things, you know. Sometimes you'll see a cap on one bottle and you're like, oh, but I saw that on this bottle. And then you compare them and they're identical. And you're like, okay, so this must have been bottling here. And there's a million tiny little threads you can tie together, whether it's verbiage on the label. We had a bottle of old cork that I'd never seen in my life before from 1920. And it said fragrant as a rose on it, which is the Mammoth Cave slogan. So it's like, okay, you put that together. It's easiest to do if you're already surrounded by a bunch of vintage whiskey, which I luckily am every day. I mean, you know, start with Google, go from there, you know?
I get hit up all the time from auction houses and places to like validate bottles. And I have a bunch of tools that I have from like the old days of like, you know, prior to 1950, they published a lot of details. Like the trade would publish details and they would have actual blue books. And it's very easy to validate bottles from that period. And there was also a lot of like bootleggers who would try to like fake stuff from back in that time. Do you ever get any like products that might have, you know, that were bootlegged or any kind of like you spot any like counterfeit kind of stuff?
Period fakes are almost more fun because, you know, you're seeing, you know, I've never, to my knowledge, we've not had anybody bring one to us, but it is a little bit more intimidating to walk through the door with something where you have to be there in person and say, you know,
right,
do you want this? Because the boy's response, if there's any question whatsoever, is, well, let's open it. And, you know, if you want to do that, you know, we can do that right now, sell it out in the bar. If you don't, then we're going to walk away from this. But I've yet to find one that was, I guess, good enough to be considered a period fake. It's more common to see them that they're faked modernly, you know?
Yeah. Do you remember the house in New York? They lived in an old bootlegger's house and they found all of these like old bottles. Remember that one?
I remember it was during the pandemic because the people were taking off like the siding on
and
the house.
And they had like it was like the big
and they were in boxes.
They looked like pints, but they were bigger. They were
that's right.
Yeah,
and I researched it, and that was the most counterfeit bottle of Prohibition from Canada coming in. And I was like, if that guy was a bootlegger, you know, I can't remember the name of the brand. It was. But it was like, I was like, it's most likely a fake. And I put that out there and I got so much hate mail from people.
Because it went viral. Went viral. And you're the only one opposing it out of the entire world.
I know, I'm like the only naysayer.
I think a healthy dose of skepticism is always going to be, you know, absolutely necessary in this industry, especially when you're dealing with wanting clients to have the real deal. So, yeah, I'm sorry that happened, but
that's normal for me.
Yeah.
It's the normal day of the week.
Is there anybody awkward instances where they're like, no, this is real. And then you're like, I'm sorry, it's not. And they're just like,
I've had people push back, or say it was a gift or that their dad passed it to them. And I'm like, oh, I'm just going to pass on it for today. I don't, you know,
right.
I'm not going to fight anybody. Like, I just don't want it.
So you have to negotiate on the bottle then, mm-hmm. when they come in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so for those listening, it's legal in the Commonwealth of Kentucky after a vintage bill was passed that a licensed retailer can acquire a bottle from an individual. That is, the bottle can no longer be in distribution. And so that's what you all do there, is you all are acquiring bottles there. And so you're actually negotiating with people. And that's one of the things when, you know, Justin's comes up a lot and some of these bourbon forums and everything, everyone talks about like the price. I'm like, they're not buying from distributors. They're buying from individuals. And those are not, that's not a regular Blanton's or Rock Hill Farms. That's 5-6 years old or thereabouts, something like that. Question for you, what's the most popular item in Justin's House of Bourbon that you sell that's not in the vintage or in the highly allocated kind of?
It's Blanton's.
No, it's Chicken Cock.
Is it Maker's Mark?
Chicken Cock is up there. Chicken Cock is up there. Cooper's Craft is up there. Those are hand sales. It's just some that we like to recommend that, you know, people don't usually see. Our number one seller, we are the number one account for it and have been for 3 years, is J.W. Dant.
No way.
If you come into my shop from outside of Kentucky, I will tell you all about J.W. Dant. I will tell you about...
Tell us some, share some bits and nuggets for our fans out
here. It's one of the longest running brands in bourbon. They haven't changed the label much, if at all. It's $15 and it's bottled in bond Heaven Hill product. If you are sitting out there somewhere hurt and sad that you can no longer get Heaven Hill white label, 6-year bottled in bond, J.W. Dant will soothe your soul.
Isn't that Kentucky only?
According to Bernie Lubbers, very, very hard to find outside Kentucky, a little bit of distribution in Indiana, but he refers to it as the gold dust. Obviously, you come to Kentucky, you want that bottle of Blanton's or whatever rare, limited, you know, Old Forester has just come out. And those are the gold, you know, the gold nuggets that you want to grab when you see them. But the gold dust is all over, you know, on the floor beneath your feet. And you reach down to the bottom shelf. This is all Bernie Lubbers. This is not me. And you grab that bottle of J.W. Dant and you take that home with you because it's perfect for toddies. It's perfect for drinking neat.
Yeah.
It's great. Yeah,
it's such an incredible, incredible iconic name. I mean, the Dant family really, they rivaled Beam in the case of Stephen Beam, is a Beam. And so...
Why didn't they survive? They
made decisions that were contrary to the family name. You know, they just sold. You know, they got out of the game.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, because I read it from the lawsuit that was recently settled from Heaven Hill and everything like that, was that... it was a few generations later and the family just didn't want to take it over. And so the aunts just sold it on the market or whatever. And it went through a few different hands that traded, but ended up in Heaven Hills.
I should know this. My family farm's like 10 minutes from there. But
that's the thing about bourbon is like we hold a lot of these names up and we revere them. But to so many, like bourbon was just like, they didn't give two shits about it from 65 to, you know, 95, you know, so it's kind of great to see that. But I chuckled when you said that they haven't changed the label. That's because, like, you know, Max Shapiro from Heaven Hill is like, we ain't spitting one red cent on like changing these labels, you know.
it gets no publicity. It makes the same amount of money every year. They make the same amount of bottles every year. No advertising, no updating. There's, I think, whatever plastic caps they have on hand go on top. I've seen white, I've seen red.
I think that was the controversy with the whole lawsuit. They're like, you all haven't spent any money on this product, but you're fighting to protect the name.
It makes X amount of dollars every year for Heaven Hill, and it drinks like a beast. So
JTS Brown's in that same league, you know.
It's his brother, yeah.
And then you have the Heaven Hill Green Label, 6-year, 90 proofer. Just so many great ones like that. That's great to know that that's the number one. What's number two?
Chicken Cock and Cooper's Craft are definitely hand sells that a lot of people on my team like. The other ones that my favorite, like, you know, they're like, what's a good bottle for $50? New Riff Single Barrel. I would drink New Riff Single Barrel all day. I have 20 odd of them at the house. And
they're great.
They're so good. And so when people come in looking for something kind of cool, you know, that they don't see as often. And now New Riff's definitely started to expand their distribution. But that's my hand sell every time. Yeah.
Okay, so you're going to help me, you're going to hand sell me a vintage bottle here. So we talked about the new stuff. So
how much money do you have?
I'm getting there. Fred. Hold on, baby bird. I'll feed you. So I got $1,000. I can spend it on anywhere between 1 to 3 bottles. Where do you guide me?
You're going to get one.
What do you like to drink today?
I'd say I'm a new whiskey drinker. I just like Maker's Mark. I just want something fun to be able to try.
Okay, cool. So you like that kind of 90 proof, a little bit softer.
Sure.
Yeah, well, that's great because, you know, when you're talking about dusty bottles, a lot of them in the ages, where we call the glut era, kind of that 90 or 65 mm-hmm. to 95 range, bourbon was proofed down quite a bit. You know, people didn't want whiskey too much. They wanted gin and vodka and drugs. So
drugs, so, LSD.
So they took bourbon down, you know, from its usual 100 proof to the minimum proof, which is 80. So we'll find you something nice and light. Okay. So you like caramel flavors?
Sure.
All right.
Yeah. I'm going to let you guide me here. Kind of guide me through.
He likes, actually, that. He likes, well, sweet oak. Let me help
yeah.
you.
Yeah, okay. Sweet oak. Yeah,
sweet oak. Sure. Well, he was giving me absolutely nothing. So I know. He did something.
He likes, he likes a little bit of tannic.
He likes
that's perfect.
These guys know me better than my own wife sometimes.
When I say glut era, I mean bourbons that have been aged quite a bit longer than the bourbons are aged today. So if you like tannic, if you like oak, you're really lucky if you're looking for dusty bourbon. A lot of oak and a low proof is pretty classic for a lot of the Heaven Hill brands that we were talking about. You know, the 40,000 odd dusty brands that went through their hands, whether for export or here. So let's go take a look at a couple of those.
So give me,
I know the one.
It's virgin,
15-year virgin bourbon.
15-year virgin bourbon. That's
it's going to be 15-year Anderson Club.
Oh, shoot. Yeah.
Well, that's a good one, too.
Damn, I'm sorry.
So that's how it would go.
Out of those 40,000 labels that we all talk about, because you've probably seen more than I have or known about.
They pop up every day. I have a list. Like, Heaven Hill cats and dogs on my computer, and I just add to it.
Really?
That's all I do.
Give me some of the ones that are like the wild ones that you've come across.
Oh, man. I don't think I've looked at the list for a month and a half at this point, but the Virgin Bourbon's funny, obviously. Nothing's coming to mind. You've put me on the spot. I'm frozen miserably.
It was like Bourbon Supreme. I'd never seen Bourbon before.
Really?
Yeah.
We had talked about this one. The ROB.
Yes.
They call it Very Old ROB, and it stands for Very Old Rare Old Bourbon, like ATM machine. They're just repeating this. But I like the Very Old Robs.
Yeah.
Kentucky Rifle, some of the funniest ones, and this isn't Heaven Hill one, but some of the funniest ones are just brands that didn't intend for the bourbon to ever stay in the United States. It was always going to be an export. And so it just kind of had to be a postcard from America almost. So when you're looking at the old KBD Monument Valley, the Pre-Fire Heaven Hill old Kentucky Rifle, you know, like Monument Valley is nowhere near Kentucky. But if you're in Japan where this bourbon is headed, you know, to us, it's like, oh, this is the geishas and the sakura flowers. Like they go, this is the same thing. You know?
Yeah.
It's not at all, but it just meant America. So those are the funniest ones to me where they're just like aggressively Americana.
Yeah, in Japan, thank God for Japan, because that was the only country drinking bourbon.
Kept us afloat.
Help bring it back.
It did. So I guess, you know, one of the other things I kind of want to talk about, just because you're such a wealth of knowledge when it does come from the dusty side of things, is how do you continue sort of like that education when you are going through this? Is it just through a lot of research and continually to try to find? And you had mentioned a spreadsheet. Like, do you continually make notes and go back to them?
I try to, you know. I definitely am sure there's certain things that I haven't written down that I've forgotten. One time I Googled a brand and I found an article that I had written 4 years ago on it. So I definitely, you know, I've forgotten some things that I need to go back and update my sheets. But I'm lucky in that every day I've got a new reason to research. You know, every day a new bottle comes in, every day, you know, something pops up and I can go look into it or hop to the Phil Center wherever and sit and read about it. But I would also say that one of my favorite things to do, and this has just led me down so many wonderful rabbit holes, is to go on the old message boards from like 2000 on straightbourbon.com.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
And just read wherever my mouse lands, just read hundreds of comments. Julian Van Winkle giving out his personal cell phone number, begging people to come to his distillery, you know, Veach and Cowdery just chatting casually about whatever bourbon happened to be around. I mean, it's just an untapped wealth of information that I every day find something new in. So,
Bourbon Enthusiast too. The bourbonenthusiast.net's a great one.
Yeah
that's a treasure trove. I talk about it all the time, like how that was the original like social media. Like it started in like 98 99. It's amazing.
Well, it's unfortunate that Facebook does not provide you the same SEO and search engine capabilities that a lot of these do too, because you can ask a question to Google, you're not going to go into the plethora of like what is in Facebook knowledge realm either. So
you think they're going to share like metadata?
You can do that in the groups section. You can search.
Yeah, but you actually have to go to the group to make it happen. It's a lot easier just to go.
And then you have to go through like 75 memes before you get to anything worth a shit.
They're all about Blantons.
Yeah, it's all about Blantons.
This brings up a good question. Do you think like archaeology for the future is like, man, that's weak. You don't even have to dig a shovel. You just got to do a Google search, you know? Like,
oh no,
for like what we're doing now for people. archaeologists in the future, you know.
Oh, I gotcha. I gotcha.
You know.
No, because they'll have to go find Kenny's bones and bottles somewhere.
Yes,
but
there you go. It all comes all back. Right.
But no, it's certainly far more helpful when someone keeps reference of what they've been doing and writes it in a space that can be saved. But no, archaeology will always require an amount of manual labor. Yeah,
I think, you know, the future of archaeology is probably going to be like, how are you going to read this technology? Like, if you, for example,
what blockchain do I have to get on?
Like, if you think about like a beta disc or a beta tape, if you found something from like the late 70s, early 80s, like, and you have this incredible piece of history that's on a beta, like, good luck finding something to play that.
Yeah, I was about to say.
You know, in like 500-600 years, when dirt's crusted over us or water's like taken over Kentucky, whatever it may be.
Waterworld,
another pandemic.
Lexington's on a plateau. Y'all have fun over here.
And then there's this special preserved, like, Justin's House of Bourbon with a special spreadsheet. And the person writing about bourbon at this point is going to be like, who's this Caroline person? What's this all about? They're gonna have to
listen to this podcast.
They're gonna have to figure out a way to unlock that data. So
look at the notes she wrote on that New Riff. That sounded good.
New Riff writes their own notes.
And
it's
lost her taste and smell.
Because Jay's
so
good at it.
He's an English.
Oh my God.
I've been trying to get him to write a book on Northern Kentucky Cincinnati distillers for 10 years now.
Wow.
Every time I see him, like, where's the book? So if you're listening, Jay, which I know you do, write that friggin' book.
No, I like I said, love writing my tasting notes. It's just a nice excuse for me to sit quietly and drink for half an hour. And his are already done. So for my favorite craft distillery, it's like, oh, okay. Well.
Speaking of books, when can we expect one from you?
I was about to say, it was kind of...
I thought Fred was going to say, I got another one coming.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, when are you going to take a lot of this information that you've had and either, like, open source it or turn it into something like that?
This is a two-part answer to this one. Number one, when I feel like I'm enough of an authority to write a book. I have never been on a podcast before because until today, I couldn't convince myself that my dumbass opinions were as valid as anybody else's.
Hey, we go through imposter syndrome to this day.
Yeah. So number one, when I feel like I can write a book. But number two, I have actually recently been given by, like I said, Justin Sloan and Justin Thompson, who have given me literally everything so far, given a set of documents that I think will prove super, super interesting. Nothing I can talk about now. I think you guys might have heard a little bit about it when you were visiting with us, but
we'll talk about it off air.
We'll talk about it off air, not to be rude, but...
dun, 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 dun. And with that, check in next week.
The cliffhanger for y'all. No, but I've been given a set of documents that I think will end up being really special.
Well, let me just say this. You have proven yourself entirely, and I have seen people with far less merit write books. Believe me, and
I've seen podcasters listen. I'm looking at one in the mirror.
So I think, you know, whatever, if I can help push you over that edge, if I can help you in any way with the book writing path, they are a pain in the ass, but they're a big joy to do, and I'm happy to support in whatever way I can. And purely the Justin Squared plus Seth, you know, giving you all the support they have over the past decade, that's all I need to know in terms of, like, your work ethic and everything.
Well, I'm all warm and fuzzy. It's not even the Pursuit Rye, man.
He does that. He's a big teddy bear from time to time.
Jeez.
Occasionally.
Yeah.
But just Caroline, staring the ascot, it's hypnotizing.
It's the polka dots, man. Can't look away.
But Caroline, I do want to say thank you so much for coming on the show today. It was a pleasure to get to know more about you and your background. I think it's interesting the way that you kind of took it from your party days in Wisconsin to coming.
I never said party days.
Well, I'm going to assume with the Halloween story.
Fred and Caroline, that's your first book, Fred and Caroline's Guide to Wisconsin. That's coming up soon. Is that those special documents you're talking about?
Yeah, there you go. It's the autobiography we all need to read there. But as I said, it really is a pleasure to kind of get to see your history of how you kind of went there. It's funny because people talk about, like, ski bums bumming around. You actually were kind of like an archaeology bum. You're, like, bumming around and kind of doing
we're
stuff
called
like
that. Shovel bums.
Shovel bums?
Yeah,
is that
shovel
what it
bums.
Is?
You work all over. Whoever's got a contract for you, yeah.
Okay, see? Nice. I learned something new today, too. But it is cool to kind of see how you took these two passions and kind of started, like, molding or melding them together. And now that you're taking over a lot of things in the historian side at Justin's House of Bourbon, as I mentioned before, I've always been impressed with the amount of knowledge that you have that you're able to share. When I show you a picture and you're able to show, oh yeah, this was coming from this distillery, or it's worth this much or anything like that. It's always, like I said, a huge help, at least for me. And I know that a lot of the people can probably get it out there. So if people want to know more about you, where they can follow you online, how they can find you in the shop and buy a dusty bottle from you, how do they do that?
Yeah, couple Instagrams. My personal is Miss Whiskey Historian. The shops are going to be House of Bourbon, KY, Lou, and Lex. And then Bourbon Review, all on Instagram. So you'll see writing and bottles and photos there. You can come see me at House of Bourbon Lexington. I'll pour you whatever new riff we got handy. You got to pay for the dusties though, sadly. But but yeah, we would love to hear from anybody. Yeah.
No, that's really cool. And if you have dusties, make sure you go bring them to her. She's going to tell you if they're valid or not, and they're going to say, open them. We'll let
prove
you know.
It. Yeah, prove it.
Let me drink. I'll find out. Yeah.
Well, cool. So make sure you follow her, follow Bourbon Review, everything like that, but also follow us, Bourbon Pursuit, on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. And if you also want to get caught up on the latest news and never miss an episode, bourbonpursuit.com, sign up for our newsletter, and also follow our good friend Fred Minnick over here as well. But with that, cheers, everybody. We'll see you next week.